Tom is also great, and he'll be on the job market next year if you're looking for good postdocs. And we wrote two papers last year, and we're doing some more work. And my student, Thomas Roxlow, is also involved in that work. So what I want to tell you about is the weak gravity conjecture. And I'm going to tell you a bit about how it relates to inflation, which is how I got into this. You know, I'm mostly a phenomenologist, and so I try to only work on questions that are somehow connected with data, and the data that got me into this particular question was Bicep's apparent measurement of a large tensor to scalar ratio, which, as we all know now, was not really a measurement of a large tensor to scalar ratio, but at least got me thinking about these theories. I'll remind you that this relates to super Planckian and field ranges during inflation, and the weak gravity conjecture gives us some reason to doubt those. But recently, what I've been really excited about is not the specific applications to inflation, but this conjecture itself, because I think it potentially has a lot to tell us about the nature of quantum gravity. And there's a particular version of it that we've been thinking about called the lattice weak gravity conjecture. So I'll explain to you kind of the logic of how we got to thinking about this statement and some of the reasons why we think it might be true. And then at the end of the talk, I'll come back and connect some of the things I've said to inflation again.
Will you be elaborating on why the weak gravity forbids
superplanking? I will, yeah. To say that it forbids them is maybe a little bit too strong, but at least it forbids certain models of them. And
because there's examples of superplanking fields that clearly do make sense. Vanilla extra dimensional models.
Right. So you have in mind like non-compact moduli, right?
Or, yeah, just radii or say a picture.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So most of the examples I'll be talking about are axions. So they're compact fields, and in that case, I think the arguments are stronger. Yeah. For the non-compact fields, I agree that they're examples. Whether or not they're models that are totally controlled enough that we should believe you can inflate in those directions, I'm not sure. But at least the specific arguments I'll make are only about the compact axions. Okay, so let me start with inflation. And I'm going to go through this kind of quickly because for some of you, I think it'll be review. But if you want me to explain anything more, stop me and I'll go into more detail. During inflation, the universe is approximately De Sitter space, so it's expanding with a constant Hubble. And the two-point function of a field in De Sitter space looks like this. It looks like Hubble squared divided by k cubed. This is the scale invariant two-point function. The important part for thinking about tensor to scalar ratios, so if Bicep had measured R, or if some future experiment does measure R, what that's telling us is that the amplitude of tensor perturbations during inflation is not extremely small compared to the amplitude of scalar fluctuations. So where do the tensor and scalar fluctuations come from? In both cases, essentially, this estimate for the two-point function of a canonically normalized scalar is something we want to start with, and then you just sort of rescale to get the appropriate normalization of the different fields. For tensor fields, the appropriate normalization comes from the Einstein-Hilbert term, and what that means is the two-point function of a graviton in De Sitter space has an extra factor of m Planck squared in the denominator. So that's the relatively easy one. The expression, which is a little bit more complicated, is the case of scalars. The two-point function of the scalar perturbation in the metric has this extra factor relative to the graviton of h squared over h dot. So where does that come from? One way to think about it is the scalar mode wouldn't be part of the metric at all if we didn't break time translation invariants. So in ordinary GR around flat space, we think about metrics propagating tensor degrees of freedom as gravitational waves. We don't think about scalars propagating. But if you break time translation invariants, you get a Goldstone boson of that spontaneously broken symmetry, which is eaten by the graviton. That's the thing that becomes the scalar perturbation. And the funny normalization of the two-point function is related to the fact that this h dot goes to zero limit is the limit where you restore time translation symmetry. You restore the De Sitter invariants. And in that limit, this kind of eaten Goldstone picture stops making sense. So that's the intuition behind why you should have an h dot in the denominator. But when we're thinking about slow roll inflation, what that means is the amplitude of these scalar perturbations is generally going to be big compared to the amplitude of the tensor perturbations because that h dot is a small number when we're working in slow roll inflation. Okay, so I guess I just said these words basically. so I don't need to repeat them. Okay. So the h dot is the rate of change of the Hubble expansion. It's how far you are from being in pure de Sitter space. But in a slow roll model, you can relate that to the kinetic term of your scalar field that's evolving. And if we use this to translate the h dot into a phi dot, the ratio of tensor power to scalar power is proportional to phi dot squared. And what that means is you can relate the size of this ratio of tensor power to scalar power to how big a change you had in your scalar field over the course of inflation. So a big tensor to scalar ratio means a big change in the value of your scalar field. And if you try to make that quantitative, you get what's called the Lyth bound, which says that if r is about 0.01 or bigger, your field has moved a distance in field space of about the Planck mass or more. Okay, the exact coefficients in this depend on your particular model of inflation. They depend on whether you're really talking about slow roll or you have corrections. But the general idea here is in fact very general. And if you ever see a large tensor to scalar ratio produced by density perturbations during inflation, it's signaling a field range that's big compared to M Planck. Okay.
Do your delta phi there intends to be the across the observable range of scales or all of the rest of inflation from horizon?
Good. Right. So I'm forgetting exactly why I pulled out 0.01 as opposed to some slightly different choice, but you're right. It depends on whether we're sort of assuming that this estimate is based only on the directly observable things, or we're sort of extrapolating to 60 E folds, which we may not directly see in the CMB. The kind of qualitative message is the same either way, but the quantitative details are a little bit different. So yeah, that
I'm not too bothered about the numbers. I'm interested to know which it is you think you're doing, whether you really want to restrict yourself to the
right
observable scales, or whether you want to try and say something that is more general.
I guess what I would say is, if you observe R at the level that is detectable now or will be in the coming years, it's very hard to arrange a model of inflation that works that doesn't involve a super Planckian range. We could try to get quantitative about this in particular models, and it might be that if you think that what you're not observing is somehow the potential is deviating radically from what it is during the era that you're directly observing, you might be able to change the specific numbers here a little bit. Yeah. Okay. So so why should we be bothered by super Planckian field ranges? Well, one thing that you may hear people say is effective field theory tells us we shouldn't trust super Planckian field ranges. And there's a simple argument for that, which is, let me just start writing down an effective Lagrangian. I should write down not only these simple terms we're used to, but higher dimension operators. These are suppressed by some cutoff scale, which shouldn't be any bigger than M Planck. Certainly, we stop trusting our effective field theory of gravity at the Planck scale. And if I write down all of these operators, and I start looking at super Planckian field ranges, all of the operators matter, and I get these crazy potentials that wiggle all over the place. Okay, so that's an argument that many people say, but it's not really right. It's perfectly compatible with effective field theory to talk about super Planckian field ranges, but the thing you have to invoke is some sort of symmetry that suppresses all of these higher dimension operators. And we know how to do that in quantum field theory. We can keep a potential very flat over a very long range by having a very good approximate global shift symmetry of the field. So if I have a good global shift symmetry, these different higher dimension operators in the potential break it, but as long as there's some small parameter controlling that breaking, that small parameter will appear as a spurion in front of every single term here, and they can all be small. The quartic term will have to be of order the mass squared divided by the field range F squared, and so on. So effective field theory doesn't really tell us that we can't trust super Planckian field ranges. A measurably large value of R is not really incompatible with effective field theory.
Can I make my usual complaint at this point? Because I think that the statement is, you know, what you're saying is not wrong, but the statement you're making is kind of, it's in a way which makes it sound like two things are fighting and we are not fighting. So I would say that effective field theory doesn't have a statement either way as to whether or not you could have large fields or not large fields. The issue is whether or not you're having a large energy for getting a large field, right? Because you really, effective field theory is saying you have to be low energies.
Yeah.
And if it happens you've got flat direction or something, then there's no energy cause large fields at all, and those are perfectly good.
Good.
And so that then a sufficient condition for that would be shift symmetries, but that's not the only thing that would happen. So the real thing is, and it's also true that it's all very field definition specific the way it's being phrased, right? Because mm-hmm. you take 5 with the 1/5, and now I've got small fields, and really there's kind of a statement being made about the target space metric and physical distances in the target space. And so if you have some reason for understanding the geometry of your target space, take a large field for you, that's all you really need. And that's one way to do it, but not the only way.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I figured you would.
I think a similar philosophical point to Cliff. There's two different things here about the superplanck class. One is whether you believe that the potential really becomes somehow non-flat, mm-hmm. or whether you simply believe that you don't know how to calculate it and you don't know how to verify. Now, I think everyone pretty much agrees that you don't know how to calculate the potential at very large mm-hmm. values, so you can't tell whether it's flat. It seems to me it's no more likely to be flat or non-flat just because it happens to be large corrections, because those corrections are as likely as
well, what I would say is there's a question of how natural it is to find a theory with a flat potential.
So if you... I think that if you're supposing it happened that your potential came to you as a series of e to the minus pi or something like that, then you would know that it's flat. And it would be calculable, but this would be a really bad idea to expand the powers of pi. There's nothing that says you have to expand the powers of pi.
Sure. Yeah.
And it probably depends whether people believe that the potential is like you've drawn some kind of stochastic wiggly thing. It seems to me it's a stochastic wiggly thing when you impose some large correction that you may or may not know how to calculate. You will still finish up with some large scale wiggly thing, which will have some flat regions and some not. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be obvious to me that having large corrections was going to make it any more or less likely to be flat than it was before you imposed any of these corrections. In particular, models, because that might not be true.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of questions you can ask about what is the measure on the space of, you know, inflationary models that you might find in quantum gravity that are consistent. But I guess what I'm saying here is there's a certain intuition that it shouldn't be so easy to find very flat potentials unless there's a good reason for them to be very flat. One reason for them to be very flat is the existence of some approximate symmetry. So I'm not going to claim that everything I say is valid for all models, but I want to investigate this issue of a good approximate shift symmetry and sort of ask, if this is the explanation for why you would get a flat potential over a large range, is it an explanation that we believe makes sense? And the reason to have a doubt about it is that we know that quantum gravity theories have no continuous global symmetries. So this was a valid argument about effective field theory and global symmetries, but we don't really believe that global symmetries make sense when we turn on gravity. And there's a familiar argument for that. One version of this argument has been written down relatively recently by Banks and Seiberg, but many people have made these arguments over many years. Essentially, the argument is that if you tell me I have a quantum gravity theory with a global symmetry, I can take a black hole and just start chucking stuff into the black hole that's charged under that global symmetry. And the black hole has no hair, so I can't measure from outside the black hole that it is carrying these charges. I should still trust Hawking's calculation that tells me it evaporates, because from outside the black hole, this looks like any other black hole. And so it should shrink down until the point where I stop trusting effective field theory, and I can't tell you what it does after that point. But what I can tell you is that by starting out with different amounts of charge and really big black holes and letting them evaporate, I can get lots of different states that are roughly the size of my cutoff, the point where I stop trusting effective GR. And if I can have arbitrarily many states of different charges of this size, of whatever my smallest black hole size is that I trust, that could violate various entropy bounds. When I say Bekenstein bound, I really mean the bound that depends on M Planck, not the one that doesn't. Maybe I should say the covariant entropy bound, whatever your favorite version of these entropy bounds is.
Is there an argument along this for those of us who think the information problem is resolved?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I certainly think the information problem is resolved, but.
At least I interpret it as, you're essentially losing information in the black hole, and so if you get in trouble, so this can't happen.
I'm not saying you lose.
That's actually not true.
I'm not saying you lose information. I'm saying the information is still there. And so let me try to repeat the argument a little more precisely and see if it satisfies you. I would say. So So I certainly believe that unitarity is preserved by black hole evaporation, but what I'm saying is, I also believe that I should be able to trust Hawking's calculation over some range of length scales for which effective field theory makes sense. And over that range of length scales, I can't distinguish between a black hole that carries this global charge and one that doesn't. Now, I believe that there are different microstates that will tell me if it's carrying a global charge, but I can't distinguish them. And so I should trust the calculation that tells me these black holes will shrink. Now, when they shrink, the information should still be there about this charge. And so I should have very many different states, which are distinguishable quantum states. If they had somehow become indistinguishable, that would violate unitarity, because we know if we're saying that this is a good quantum number, we're assuming that this charge is preserved by the time evolution. Okay, so we're going to have all these different states. And if you believe that there's some bound on the number of states in some volume coming from arguments like Bousso's arguments about the covariant entropy bound, then this could violate those entropy bounds. So I never assumed here that unitarity is violated. I certainly don't want to assume that.
Yeah, I'd say it's
another
thing, but keep on going.
So I have a question. You are going to break this incidentally anyway.
Sure.
Is the argument still valid if you have approximate shift symmetry?
Well, I guess the question is, why do you expect that an approximate shift symmetry makes sense? And what the models I'm going to talk about, well, OK, maybe what I want to say is, if I trust that an approximate symmetry makes sense, I should somehow believe there's some limit in which it's a good symmetry that I'm perturbing around.
Yep.
Otherwise, invoking a symmetry that has no limit in which it is restored is just kind of like writing down all of these coefficients by hand to have some values.
Sorry, I'm confused, because if you have a gauge symmetry, right, and you use the quantum mass, let's say the black hole has a good quantum number, the symmetry is unbroken.
Yeah.
If the quantum has a mass, now that what happens to the charge of that, it's a discontinuous field for gauge symmetries and black holes, right? The statement was that if you have a broken gauge symmetry, you start creating black holes out of those, the charge is not, it's not conserved. The pair of the charge will retain a finite amount of time.
I don't think you said anything I disagree with. What's the question?
No, the question is, if for gauge symmetries, there appears to be this continuous. Let's say you have a gauge symmetry, right?
Yeah.
If it's massive, you know you can have charged black holes.
Right.
If it's massive, you cannot. Because of the non-hair theory.
Sure.
Okay, so why is it couldn't there be a continuous bound here?
Exposing a gauge couple is really, really small.
Well, it doesn't matter if the gauge couple
is small. That would be limited, so this would be saying that this continues.
So basically, if you don't have an exact shift symmetry, then there is no conserved charge, so there's nothing.
Right. Well, I want to perturb around exact symmetry. So what I'm trying to say here is you shouldn't believe there's an exact global symmetry. What I want to get to is that we're going to assume that there's an underlying gauge symmetry, which is the real explanation for this approximate symmetry in our EFT. I think trying to think through the answer to Mina's question is going to take me longer than I should take out of the talk at the moment. Let's talk more about it later. Okay, so these arguments against global symmetries motivate thinking about gauge symmetries, which we believe do exist in theories of quantum gravity. And in fact, if you start looking at models of inflation in string theory, many of them are building on underlying gauge symmetries. And in particular, one nice way to get an approximately shift symmetric scalar field, again, not exactly, but approximately, is to start with a gauge symmetry in a higher dimensional theory, compactify that theory, and then if you have some p-form gauge field integrated over a p-cycle in your compactification, this becomes a scalar field with a gauged shift symmetry, a discrete gauge shift symmetry, meaning it's a compact field. The field lives on a circle. And if you add some constant to the field, you get exactly the same physical state that you started with. Okay. So the simplest case, this is a circle. This is just an ordinary gauge field. We integrate it over the circle. And there's a large gauge transformation around the circle. which descends to this 2 pi shift symmetry of the axion. Okay, so this is a good way to get compact fields out of underlying gauge symmetries. The compactness is a gauge symmetry, it's not a global symmetry. And you can have an approximate continuous global symmetry reflecting the fact that anything that violates this anything that violates the continuous shift symmetry somehow has to know about the whole size of this internal thing. And so if this internal thing has a big volume, effects that sort of know about its whole size are non-local and they're exponentially suppressed. So in this way, you find a lot of fields coming out of string theory that from the low energy observer's point of view look like the kind of field that you want. They look like fields where all of these higher dimension operators have small numbers in front, reflecting kind of a slightly broken, what looks to the low energy observer like a slightly broken global symmetry, but in reality is coming from a gauge symmetry in the higher dimensional theory. Okay, so you might think all we need to do is find an axion somewhere in string theory that has a decay constant bigger than M Planck and we have an inflation model. And people tried to do that, but it's not easy. And as Banks and others argued in 2003, the examples where you could try to push to this limit tend to not be under calculational control. So there are doubts about whether these fields actually exist. Okay, that led to a lot of clever model building, which I can characterize in roughly 3 categories. The first one is called enflation. It says, okay, I can't find you a field that has a decay constant bigger than M Planck, but maybe what I can find is a bunch of fields that have decay constants smaller than M Planck, such that if I can move along some trajectory in field space where all of them are changing, I could get a total distance bigger than M Planck. That's one of the attempts. Another idea is alignment, which is due to Kim, Nillis, and Peloso. That's the idea that even if there are only 2 fields, I have this small compact space these 2 fields live in, but I might be able to take some path in that space that's actually very long. In particular, it might be that my mass eigenstates are some funny linear combinations of these, such that one of them has a super short range and the other one has a really long range along this diagonal. And the third idea is monodromy, which Eva Silverstein and Alexander Westphal and others have developed a lot over the last several years. And that's the idea that I can have one of these compact fields, but such that if I adiabatically go around the compact circle, my physical state can change a little bit, and I can kind of move between different branches in such a way that it effectively looks like I have a non-compact field, even though I have one of these underlying gauge invariances. So all of these ideas have been advocated as ways to build models of large field inflation that are controlled by underlying gauge symmetries. So we don't have to worry about any of these doubts about what global symmetries mean in quantum gravity. We're starting with gauge symmetries, and we're getting large field ranges. And again, from the effective field theory viewpoint, this is all OK. From this viewpoint that we don't want to talk about global symmetries in quantum gravity, this is OK. But there are still doubts about whether these theories really exist as consistent quantum gravity theories. So it's been suggested that they might be in what's called the swampland, which is Kammerer and Vaffa's name for things that look reasonable from the low energy point of view, but that aren't fully consistent quantum gravity theories. And Vaffa and others proposed, in particular, something called the weak gravity conjecture, which is kind of a sharp version of why we might doubt these theories. So to tell you what the weak gravity conjecture is, I should first remind you about extremal black holes. In general relativity, if I give you a black hole with some charge under some massless gauge field, there's a minimum mass for that black hole. For 4-dimensional black holes, essentially this mass is just the charge in Planck units. If black holes are charged under multiple U1s, this generalizes for sort of a typical theory of U1s, this will just become a square root of the sum of the squares of the charges. So it's important that what enters this is this particular quadratic combination. That'll play an important role later. So what Arkani, Hamid, Model, Nicholas, and Vaffa suggested is that these extremal black holes should be able to decay. They should be able to shed their charge and become black holes of smaller charge. Now, I don't think I can give you any totally convincing argument for why this should be true. But if it is true, what it means is there must exist some state in the theory whose mass is less than its charge. So some state that if you thought of it as a black hole would be super extremal, but it may not be a black hole. It may be some light particle. The electron satisfies this. Its mass is extremely tiny compared to its charge in Planck units by many orders of magnitude. So in our universe, for the one long-range abelian gauge field that we know about, this is definitely true. But the suggestion was that this should be true for any consistent theory of quantum gravity. So why should it be true? Well, they postulated it should be true so that extremal black holes should decay. Why should extremal black holes decay? I don't think they gave me any convincing reason why I should believe it to be true. We can say that it would be weird if they didn't. If I have some nearly extremal black hole and this conjecture is false, that black hole will spontaneously evolve toward being extremal. And extremal black holes are weird objects. You know, we could have them sitting around forever, never decaying, information is trapped in them. It seems strange, but seeming strange is not a very strong
reason. There is time present, but I think what you say, decay, it takes time to decay, like evolve, there's time that it takes to evolve. Is it like, from the point of view of eternity somehow, right?
You're saying if I believe they shouldn't be stable, how stable could they be?
Right.
Yeah. I don't have a clear answer to that, but yeah, I don't have a.
If things occur, let's say.
Think astrophysical black holes, for example, right?
Yeah.
They live forever and ever, effectively.
Effectively,
so
yeah.
So why aren't those problematic in a sense?
No, well.
Why does this seem strange? Yeah.
Well.
Anything, it should be strange the other way. The closer to extremality, the higher the charge, the more likely it is to discharge by radiating charged particles. Wants to be less charged, not more.
No, this is the hypothesis that things should be able to radiate charged particles.
So it's the bottom thing that I don't get. That nearly extremal guys would want to become extremal. I would think they'd want to go the other way around.
No, right. I'm saying if the conjecture is false,
yes,
they would tend to become more extremal.
Well, except they wouldn't. Right? I mean, especially if you have a Q greater than N, you're going to have Schwinger pair production of these things to discharge essentially.
No, they can only Schwinger pair produce if there is a particle whose mass is less than its charge. That's the case when the conjecture is true. If the conjecture is false, they can't Schwinger pair produce because there's kinematically nothing accessible.
Electron already has that condition, so that's not the conjecture that the electron exists.
This is a conjecture about what consistent quantum gravity theories look like, okay? And I'm saying they haven't given us a strong argument for why it should be true. I'm going to present to you what evidence we have for why this might be true, okay? But my talk will be saying there is some evidence for this. If it is true, it will have interesting consequences. I don't know that it's true, but I think we should try to explore whether it is or not. And if it is true, then charged black holes can discharge by Hawking radiation of charged particles or by Schwinger pair production of charged particles. If this is false, a charged black hole, once it's sufficiently close to extremality, cannot discharge. It's stuck with its charge. So that's the statement. Okay. So why should it be true? There's sort of this heuristic argument that if I take a very weakly coupled gauge theory, it looks a lot like a global symmetry, and I should be able to make the argument I made before. But that's not very convincing, because even if there's an arbitrarily weak gauge coupling, the black hole does have hair. I can tell from outside if it's charged or not. People have tried to make these interview-bound arguments into an actual argument for this conjecture. In particular, Tom Banks, Matt Johnson, and Asaf Shomer did this in 2006. But I haven't fully understood these arguments because I'm not sure what, in the presence of this gauge charge, which does distinguish different black holes, I'm not sure which ensemble of states we should be counting and exactly how to make a sharp argument that we have something that violates an entropy bound. So I think that there's a chance that an argument can be made along those lines. There's a chance even that it already has, but certainly I haven't understood any of those arguments. More recently, Daniel Harlow gave an interesting argument for why this should be true, which was based on ADS CFT. Let me briefly tell you about that. He said, let's look at the eternal black hole in ADS, which is holographically dual to two entangled CFTs. So we have two distinct boundaries. They each have their own Hilbert space. And that CFT statement is supposed to be an exact statement about the theory. It's two different Hilbert spaces in an entangled state. But he said, from the bulk point of view, it doesn't really look like that, because we have this Wilson line operator that stretches across the entire space and connects to both boundaries. And from the bulk point of view, it's not clear how to decompose this Wilson line operator into something that's clearly built out of a Hilbert space over here, tensored with a Hilbert space over there. It doesn't seem to factorize. So what he's hypothesizing is that the factorization should be an exact statement. The bulk is some approximate view of this exact entangled set of CFTs. And in order to make those two things compatible, it must be that the Wilson line is kind of secretly built out of Wilson lines that end on charged objects, where if those charged objects are sufficiently close together, this operator might look like that operator from the point of view of a bulk observer. So this is kind of an argument for the existence of particles of minimum charge in order to define these Wilson line operators in a consistent way. He then has some further kind of heuristic arguments for why these particles should not only exist, but should obey some bound like the weak gravity bound. I think this is very suggestive, but again, it's not totally rigorous yet. So I would say that the main reasons to believe this conjecture might be true are circumstantial. It's that we have a lot of examples of quantum gravity theories, and the conjecture seems to be true in all of them. It's true in examples of perturbative string theory. It's true in Kaluza-Klein theory, if I'm getting my gauge fields by compactifying. It's true in CFTs. I have to be a little bit careful here, because in ADS, there's another scale involved, which is the ADS curvature radius. That should somehow modify the bound. But at least in the cases of weakly curved ADS, you can check that there are lots of examples where this conjecture is true.
What about the, well, any theories with Susie, or I don't want to be pissed on because it was
possible. Right. So when I say that this is a conjecture that M is less than Q, I really mean less than or equal to. And in the case of the BPS bound, it will be the case that it has to be equal, because that's all it can be. Yeah. So really, when they say that all the extremal states should be able to decay, it means if they're allowed to decay, they should be able to decay. If they're BPS, then they will be stable, because they have to be exactly at that ratio. So it's the conjecture. The conjecture is really that a super extremal or exactly extremal state exists. OK. So what I want to do is just try to subject this conjecture to some consistency checks. And to do that, I want to think about cases with more than one gauge field. So I should tell you, what's the generalization of this conjecture to more than one gauge field? This generalization was first written down by Cliff Chung and Grant Remen. It's just a statement that if we want to ask that any extremal black hole can decay, even if that black hole has a combination of different U1 charges, there should be some charged particle that it can emit, that it can discharge. And so one way to formulate that is to say, let's, for each charged particle in the theory, we can make a vector z, which is the vector of charges of the particle divided by mass. So if I only had one u1, this is just a number. And the conjecture was there's at least one particle for which this number z is bigger than one. If I have multiple u1s, the appropriate generalization of that is to say there are multiple particles that define these vectors. And the convex hole enclosed by these vectors should contain the unit ball. That turns out to be the right condition, that any charged black hole can discharge by emitting some charged particle. And effectively, the reason that's the right condition is that the extremality bound for a Reisner-Nordström black hole with multiple U1s is the square root of the sum of the squares. Okay. If there's kinetic mixing, I should put in the appropriate metric here. But the point is that the metric on the space of gauge fields determines the thing that shows up inside the extremality bound. OK, so this convex hole condition is the generalization of weak gravity to multiple U1s. And the consistency check that Ben and Tom and I did is just to say, well, there's an easy way to get theories of multiple U1s. We can get U1s by compactifying. So we can look at Kaluza-Klein theory and get our U1s from gravity. OK, so the first check is, suppose I hand you a gravitational theory. You compactify it on a circle. You get a U1. There's a slight twist to the story, because the U1 kinetic term has some dependence on the radion field that controlled the size of the circle. So the solution is not Reisner-Nordström. You have to look at dilatonic charged black hole solutions. And there's a nice encouraging result, which is that if I take a Reisner-Nordström black hole in d dimensions, compactify, look at these dilatonic black holes in d minus 1 dimensions, the extremality bounds exactly match between those two. Okay, so if I have a flat direction for the radion, I will get these theories with the massless dilaton. They'll have slightly different black hole solutions and weak gravity in d dimensions for these Sorry, I've just conflated two things. Right, so if I start with a U1 in D dimensions and compactify, I get the thing I told you. I could also start with just gravity in D dimensions and compactify. Then I don't have anything to compare to in the parent theory, but I get a U1 in the lower dimensional theory. And it turns out that U1 also obeys the bound. Right, I guess that's what I'm saying on this slide. So, so the Kaluza-Klein gravitons are charged particles. They exactly saturate the bound when you have an unstabilized extra dimension. And the reason they exactly saturate the bound is that they're BPS states. So if this was a supersymmetric theory, the Kaluza-Klein gravitons would be BPS objects. The Kaluza-Klein monopole also turns out to saturate the magnetic version of this bound. So I haven't mentioned that, but you can always talk about magnetically charged black holes, ask that they should be able to shed their magnetic charge, and that's also obeyed by these theories. Okay, so we have two checks of these Kaluza-Klein theories. One is that a U1 theory, when we dimensionally reduce, if it obeyed the weak gravity bound in the parent theory, it still obeys it in the lower dimensional theory. And the other is that if we start with gravity and produce a U1 from that, that U1 obeys the weak gravity bound. Okay, so these look good. But this is not the full story, because I can always start with a U1 gauge theory in D dimensions, dimensionally reduce, then I have a theory with two U1s. One is the descendant of the one that I started with, and the other is the Kaluza-Klein U1 from gravity reduced on the circle. And we've checked that kind of in each direction there's a charged state with Z bigger than one. But that doesn't actually mean that the convex hull condition is satisfied. So if I hand you a black hole which is charged under both the U1 that I started with and the Kaluza-Klein U1, we need to check whether that black hole can discharge. So we have a set of Kaluza-Klein modes of the charged particle we started with. The charged particle we started with had mass less than its charge in Planck units. We've now added this additional charge that comes from the Kaluza-Klein momentum. That contributes to the mass. And so each individual Kaluza-Klein mode has z bigger than one. They're all super extremal. They all sit outside the unit ball. So that sounds good. The problem is there's only a discrete tower of Kaluza-Klein modes. So if my fundamental U1 is on the horizontal axis here and my Kaluza-Klein U1 is on the vertical axis, the graviton KK mode sit up here. I have some charged particle which obeyed the extremality bound in the parent theory. That means Z is bigger than or equal to one for that particle. And I have all the KK modes. I have the thing with one unit of KK momentum, two units, three units, four units. And they're all going to have some mass to charge ratio in this plane. Everyone is going to be outside the unit ball, but only in these discrete directions. And so if I look at a black hole whose combination of charges is not pointing in one of those directions, there's a chance that it can't decay. Okay, and whether or not it can decay turns out to depend on the radius of my compactification. So as I change the radius, I can change exactly where these points sit. In some cases, they might sit far enough out that they enclose the unit ball, but there's always some critical radius beyond which they pass inside the circle, and there are black holes that can't discharge. So what we've shown is that the weak gravity conjecture is not self-consistent. If I give you a theory that obeys it and dimensionally reduce, you can find a dimensionally reduced theory that doesn't obey the conjecture anymore.
Can you say that just you don't make those black holes?
Can you say that you don't make them? No, because you can always, I'm assuming that you have some charged particles in your theory to begin with. You can always take a black hole and throw in both KK gravitons and charged particles to get whatever linear combination of charges you want. And then those black holes can Hawking radiate down to nearly extremal black holes that can't decay. It might be that that particular It might be that the probability that they Hawking radiate down to exactly the thing that we're worried about is small, but at least in principle, it can happen.
Sorry, Matt, I have one more question. So in your observation, so you take a gauge U1 in the next dimension,
mm-hmm.
and then you want to make a statement about, you're still using the requirement of the black value.
Well, I can't really say it's the absence of black hole. Again, I don't think there's a remnant argument that actually justifies the conjecture. But the assumption is that every extremal black hole should be able to discharge.
Yeah, but That's the, so you're still
yeah.
using that's the requirement from the original.
That's how we're choosing to generalize the conjecture, is to say the right generalized version of the conjecture is that every extremal black hole should be able to discharge. And what we're saying is that that conjecture is kind of not internally consistent as it stands. So what do we interpret this to mean? Well, we could interpret it to mean that we should just forget about the conjecture entirely. But there are all these examples that satisfy it. So we started looking for a different conjecture that's robust, such that when we dimensionally reduce, if something obeyed the conjecture in the original theory, it will obey the conjecture in the reduced theory. And the sort of insight that led us to at least a suggestion for what this general conjecture should be is I could start with pure gravity and dimensionally reduce on a torus. So I compactify on a circle twice. And when I do that, I get an infinite family of KK modes of all possible charges under both KKU1s that I get from the torus. And every one of these has a mass determined by some formula like this. So this is an example where the weak gravity conjecture is obeyed. And the difference between this and the other thing I suggested is that here, when I compactify for the second time, I'm starting with a U1, and I'm compactifying and getting that U1 and a new U1 from the new circle. But instead of starting with just one particle that obeyed the conjecture in the theory that I started with, I have this infinite tower of KK modes that all obeyed the conjecture. And they have all possible charges. So we thought, OK, one consistent conjecture is to say there's a lattice of charges allowed by our theory. You know, Dirac quantization tells us it'll be a lattice. And suppose we actually conjecture that for every charge in that lattice, there's at least one particle with mass less than its charge. You can normalize it in the appropriate way, the right square root of the sum of the squares definition of charge. So this is a conjecture we can make. It's infinitely stronger than the original conjecture. Our first thought was, this is totally crazy. This will obviously be false. We'll find a counterexample right away. But as sort of a straw man, let's take this to be our conjecture. So we call it the lattice weak gravity conjecture. Again, it's that for any charge in the charge lattice, you'll find at least one particle, which is super extremal. So super extremal, again, meaning mass less than or equal to the charge. And we expect exact equality only for BPS objects. So we started thinking about this. In fact, this implies a statement that a particle of minimum charge will always obey weak gravity, which the original paper by Arkani Hamid, Model Nicholas, and Vafa claimed was false. And they claimed it was false based on an example in heterotic string theory. But we checked that example. And in fact, the example is not a counterexample. It's a counterexample because they were sort of interpreting the statement about minimum charge to mean the charge under a particular U1. But we're defining the charge to be the square root of the sum of the squares of all the U1s. So we can look at the heterotic string, the SO32 heterotic string. I haven't really told you how to think about non-abelian groups, but let's say we're just going to look at all the U1s inside SO32. So we have 16 U1s, the Cartan subalgebra of SO32. And we're going to say that for every point in that lattice of Cartan charges, we should find a particle whose mass is less than its charge. And if you put in all the constants, what that means is the mass squared is less than 2 q squared over alpha prime. So you can just go looking. What are the states of the heterotic string? They obey this formula. Their mass squared is given by some number of oscillator modes that are turned on plus 1/2 q squared minus 1. For the left movers, you have to level match for the right movers by turning on some number of right-handed oscillators to make this nr equal to nl plus 1/2 q squared minus 1/2. But every half integer value of nr is allowed once you take into account both r and ns states. So it turns out for any charge you give me, I can find you a state of the perturbative heterotic string which obeys this inequality. There's always some state for which z is the square root of q squared over q squared minus 2, which is always bigger than 1. So this is an example where our ridiculously strong lattice conjecture is actually true. It's easy to adapt this argument for the E8 times E8 heterotic string. This is the perturbative heterotic string. We're talking about perturbative string states. You could ask, what about black holes? There are points in the charge lattice where the charge is really, really big. So any particle is really a black hole. Well, in fact, for reasons that I don't totally understand, Yevgeny Katz, Lubash Model, and Megapati looked at this back in 2006. They wrote a paper where they looked at gravity in the presence of higher dimension operators, and they asked, do these operators tend to make extremal black holes slightly super extremal or slightly sub extremal? So you can add a bunch of higher dimension operators, compute the difference in the mass to charge ratio of a black hole, and you find that there's some linear combination of the coefficients of these operators that should be positive if the black hole becomes super extremal and negative if they become sub extremal. And what they checked is that in some examples coming from heterodic string theory, this linear combination of operators turned out to always be positive. Now, what confuses me is they said that they were doing this check as a check of the weak gravity conjecture. But the weak gravity conjecture, as originally written in these papers, only said at least one particle has to exist whose mass is less than its charge. And what they're checking here seems to be the much stronger statement that we're making, that for all of these charges, the correction goes in the right direction to make them super extremal. So in fact, they seem to have already had something like our statement in mind, although they never explicitly wrote it down in these papers. But this is a nice feature of our lattice conjecture, is especially in the context of applying these things to inflation, there was some debate about, does the conjecture mean that a particle exists, like a light weakly coupled particle, or is it enough that a big black hole exists? What do we actually think we're conjecturing? Well, here, because we're talking about all possible charges, we're kind of interpolating in between. For small charges, the states will look like particles. For really big charges, they'll look like black holes. And we should be able to dial in between. So recently, this is work that we haven't published yet, and I was actually hoping to tell you a lot more details of this today, but there's still enough subtleties that we're trying to figure out that I don't want to go into too many details. But we've been accumulating a lot more evidence for this. We have a lot more evidence from perturbative string theory. So we've checked a bunch of heterodic toroidal orbifolds. It's actually not quite as simple as this calculation. It turns out, you know, in this calculation for just the SO32 heterodic string, Z was always strictly bigger than one for at least one state. For some of the orbifolds, it turns out there are states in the twisted sectors for which Z is exactly equal to one. But we've always found things where it's either bigger than or equal to one. Or exactly equal leading order in string coupling. So there's a question of what the loop correction will do. We do have counterexamples in string orbifolds, but they're all non-supersymmetric orbifolds that don't have a stable vacuum. So it's not clear that we should be worried about those counterexamples. In other words, they're not really flat space theories at all. And sort of just checking the tree level answer is probably not a useful thing to do. We have examples from ADS-CFT. You can translate the weak gravity conjecture to a statement about the dimensions and charges of operators in CFTs. There was already one paper that appeared on the archive by Nakayama and Nomura that tries to make this kind of statement. We have a large number of examples we've looked at. You have to worry about corrections due to the ADS curvature radius, but at least some of the examples that are weakly curved seem to actually obey the strong conjecture. And we can also try to generalize this thing that Katz model and Patti did. They calculated the corrections to the semi-classical black holes, and they went and asked, is this linear combination of charges positive or negative in particular string theory examples? So they just checked some examples. But we're trying to ask, is there actually a deeper reason why this linear combination of operators has to be positive? One place you can get positivity bounds on higher dimension operators is by computing scattering amplitudes and applying analyticity and unitarity. It looks like some of those analyticity calculations give us the same linear combination of operators that determines the mass to charge ratio of the black hole. On the other hand, these arguments are not rigorous yet, because gravity scattering amplitudes always have a T-channel singularity, which makes the total cross-section infinite, so you have to be careful about exactly how you deal with this to get a well-defined bound. So I think we know how to deal with that. We're working it out, but I can't tell you that we have any proof of anything along those lines yet. But at least we're starting to build up a collection of evidence, both from the weakly coupled end in perturbative string theory and kind of from the highly nonlinear end of these semi-classical black holes. And in both cases, it looks like the conjecture we made is true in every example we can check. So I think this is really interesting. I think this conjecture we've made is the right version of the conjecture to think about. It's much stronger than the original one. If you could prove the statement about black holes, that would actually prove the original conjecture, and it wouldn't be very interesting because it would mean you have at least one particle whose mass is smaller than its charge, but that particle could be a gigantic black hole. And maybe that doesn't have many consequences for things like inflation. But this conjecture that we're making would have clear consequences for things like inflation. We've thought a little bit about non-abelian theories, always by starting with a non-abelian theory dimensionally reducing and breaking it to the Cartan. But there's probably a more natural intrinsic way to make the conjecture for non-abelian gauge groups, which is to demand that particles exist in all representations of the gauge group obeying some bound. Again, that seems to be true in string theory. But what I think is interesting is that this conjecture is kind of suggestive of stringy physics, because it's saying you have an infinite collection of particles of all possible charges obeying some bound. That seems to be what string theory wants to give you. So if the conjecture is true, I think it sort of suggests that any quantum gravity theory that makes sense would look a lot like string theory. Yeah, there should be some object where,
yeah.
So these objects may not be like weakly coupled particles. They may be black holes. They may be, you know, so in general, you're going to sort of interpolate between particles and black holes, and in the middle, you'll have strings or.
Isn't that the means there's infinite number of particles? I can write a better than the amount of representation I have.
There are infinitely many particles, but going up to arbitrarily high mass, so.
Yeah, but then why doesn't that
Because they go up to arbitrarily high mass. I mean, you don't believe that the existence of black holes decouples gravity. So the species-bound kind of things, you're counting states that exist below some cutoff.
Okay.
These things could be way above any cutoff on effective field theory. They could be like big black holes.
So it could be above and black
basically. Yeah. That's right. Okay, so that's the main thing we've been thinking about lately, is kind of what is the right version of the conjecture? Can we find evidence for it? And we just keep checking examples, and every time it seems to work. So I think there's something to it. Again, none of the arguments I made are compelling, right? I didn't give you a reason to believe this should be true, except that we keep accumulating lots of examples in which it is true.
There are lots of cases where you have counterexamples.
Yeah.
That was because they were in tachyons in there, but was it horrible?
Good. I guess I should distinguish between tachyons and tadpoles, and that you might still expect it to be true if there's a tachyon, and maybe not if there's a tadpole. I have to think about, I think some of them just have tachyons. So you might worry that if there's some time scale, they're still going to be okay for a while.
Yeah.
That's something we're still trying to figure out. I don't think I have a good answer for you, but I think we do have some examples that just have where the leading instability is a tachyon. So I do think we should worry a little bit that those are possible counterexamples, depending on exactly what the right version of the statement is. Okay. Let's see. So how much time do I have left?
So you can ask them.
Okay, but did we start exactly on time, or did we start?
Yeah,
I have another 10 minutes. Okay.
Any questions?
Okay. Okay. So I want to come back to inflation a little bit at the end of the talk, but I want to emphasize that the arguments we made about inflation were made before we had what we now think is the right version of the conjecture. And we've thought a little bit about what this stronger conjecture actually means for inflation, but I don't think we fully understand that yet. So I view all of the statements we're making about inflation as kind of very provisional. I think the story is really going to change once we know what we actually believe is the right statement to make about what weak gravity is. Okay, but if I want to talk about inflation, we want to go back to this picture where we're focused on inflationary models, where we get compact fields from gauge fields in higher dimensions. Okay, so that's, yeah.
So a question I forgot to ask when you went by the first time was, supposing that I don't know what's going on with high energies, but I'm interested in energies where Carlo curve based theories. So I've got scalars, because and things.
Yeah.
And they have a potential, which is just effectively, it's like an accidental global symmetry. And so it wouldn't contradict any of the statements about there not being any exact global symmetries.
Sure.
What, I don't know. So the argument that says that you can't have these potentials without having something fancy going on, why can't you just evade them all by saying that, that whatever is describing inflation is something like a Carl Perkins paper or something?
Good.
Accidental symmetry is not really an exact one.
Right. I would say that you could try to do such a thing, but if you try to make the decay constant bigger than in Planck, you're going to run into problems, right? So in if you're generating your theory just by breaking some approximate global symmetry, or if you have some confining theory like QCD, that scale is not going to be a scale that you're free to dial to be bigger than the Planck scale.
Right.
So
and then if you're listing the things that you don't like, K constant bigger than Planck scale sounds like that's the fundamental thing you don't like, and the existence of global symmetry may or may not be a problem.
Right. So I think what I want to say is, if you hand me an effective theory with an approximate global symmetry, there should be some argument about why I should trust that approximate global symmetry that's robust in the presence of quantum gravity. That might just mean that it's a good accidental symmetry. And that's good enough. There are questions where that's not good enough. Like if you want to use an axion to solve the strong CP problem, you need to forbid a bunch of higher dimension operators even with Planck suppressed coefficients. So in a case like that, I expect you to give me more information. It could be that there's like a gauged discrete symmetry that kills those operators, or it could be that you're getting it from a gauge field along these lines, but there should be some additional story that can explain why it's robust against gravity. And what I'm saying is, in the cases where the effective theory you're getting is descending from a gauge theory, and the thing that's kind of making it work is that gauge theory is extremely weakly coupled, there might be a reason to worry, because really weakly coupled gauge theories qualitatively kind of resemble global symmetries. And the weak gravity conjecture is an attempt to make a sharp statement that can tell us exactly when we should worry if your effective theory is arising from a very weakly coupled gauge theory. So let's try to be explicit about that. So we're getting a compact scalar field from a gauge field in higher dimensions. In general, we're going to generate potentials for those fields. They won't be flat directions, and that's because the discrete shift symmetry is an honest gauge symmetry, which tells us the potential should be periodic. But there's no continuous symmetry. The continuous symmetry is only approximate. So the statement that there's only an exact 2 pi shift symmetry is what leads us to think the potential will be periodic, like a cosine. Where you're getting the approximate global symmetry from is the fact that the prefactor can be exponentially small. And the reason the prefactor can be exponentially small is that in order to sort of know what the period of the field is, you have to sort of see the entire volume of the thing you compactified on. Okay, so you generate these instanton terms that come from wrapping world lines or world volumes of objects around the volume that you compactified on, and that's what sets the scale in front of this. Okay, so how do we translate weak gravity to a statement about inflation? In fact, the original paper by Arkani Hamid model, Nicholas and Boffa, already made one attempt to do this, and it went along these lines. They said, let's start with a 5D theory. In 5D, the weak gravity conjecture says the mass of some charged particle is less than its charge in Planck units. We're in 5 dimensions, so we have to put in m5 to the 3/2 because e5, the gauge coupling, has some dimensions. So the formulas look a little bit different. I've kind of been writing 4D formulas all along just to make things simple. When we dimensionally reduce this 5D gauge theory, we get one of these scalars, and the period of that scalar is related both to the radius of the compactification and to the gauge coupling of the 5D theory. Okay, so f squared goes like 1 over r times e5 squared. Now, if I just plug that into this inequality, multiply through by r, what I get is that m times r, which is the thing that sets the instanton action when I wrap the world line of that charged particle around the extra dimension, is less than m Planck divided by f. Okay? So their argument was, this kind of inflation model is ruled out because if f is bigger than m Planck, this instanton action is small, and I can't trust my calculation anymore. I'll have a series of corrections that go like e to the minus 2s, e to the minus 3s, and so on. And those prefactors are not small, so I can't trust the theory. that's the argument they made in the original paper. And it seems like no one really questioned that argument until the end of 2014, when De La Fuente, Saraswat, and Sundrum pointed out, in fact, the original extranatural inflation paper, I think, contained a calculation of the potential you get by wrapping rolled lines of these charged particles. It's true it has this series of instanton corrections, but it also has a prefactor, which for light particles running around the loop, goes like 1 over n to the fifth. So the e to the minus 2s term is suppressed by 1 over 32 compared to the e to the minus s term. It turns out that's enough to get a good model of inflation. So, so this original argument was not super convincing. Now, these guys also presented a different argument, which is more convincing, which is based on magnetic monopoles. So the original paper says there should also be magnetically charged particles whose mass is less than their magnetic charge in Planck units. The important thing about magnetically charged particles is they should allow us to define some sort of cutoff on our effective field theory. I can't have an effective field theory of mutually local electric and magnetic objects, and so I could interpret the size of a monopole, the classical monopole radius, as a cutoff. And if I do that, this weak gravity bound turns into the statement that the cutoff is below the gauge coupling E times M Planck. So then if I do this 5D to 4D reduction, and I demand that the radius of my 5D theory, my circle I compactify on, is bigger than this cutoff, I just directly derived that the decay constant of the axion is less than M Planck. So I didn't have to talk about the electrically charged particles at all. I just had to say there's some magnetically charged particle that lets me define a cutoff, and the cutoff is enough to get the bound. So that's a lot more convincing than the argument that was given in the original paper. So what Ben and Tom and I did last summer was to sort of look at multi-field generalizations of this argument. So we said, let's look at a theory like n-flation. I have n different axions. I'm trying to move along the diagonal in field space. That argument about monopoles charged under each of these n different groups gives me a bound that each f is less than m Planck, but you might wonder if you can win by a factor of the square root of n by going along the diagonal where each one is m Planck. Okay, but what we realize is if you want to ask that magnetically charged black holes that are charged under all the different groups can decay, you have to apply this convex hull condition. The same quadratic combination of things appears in the kinetic term of the axion, which is what determines how far you move in field space, and in the extremality bound of the black holes. And because I'm running a little bit low on time, I'm not going to go through the details. But once you take that into account, essentially the fact that it's the same quadratic function in both places actually tells you that the largest effective field range you ever get is M Planck, not just each individual axis of the field space, but the full diagonal can't be longer than M Planck. And we checked various ways of relaxing the assumption. So we looked at kinetically mixed U ones, for example. We saw that that doesn't really buy you anything. But all of these arguments we made depended on one assumption, which is that the electric charges that contribute the dominant terms in the potential are simple in the same basis that the magnetic charges that define these cutoffs are simple in. So what do I mean by simple? Let me show you the counterexample, which the Maryland group, De La Fuente, Saraswat, and Sundrum, put together. They said, let's consider a theory with two axions, A and B. They're not going to kinetically mix, but we're going to assume that there's an electrically charged particle of charge 1, 0, and an electrically charged particle of charge n, 1, where n is some big integer. And they assumed that the decay constants of the two axions are both less than M Planck. Now, by making this assumption, they never explicitly said this, but implicitly, by saying the two decay constants are less than M Planck, they're assuming that the magnetically charged particles, the magnetic monopoles that define the cutoffs, have charges 1, 0, and 0, 1. So they have a magnetic monopole charged only under group A, a magnetic monopole charged only under group B, and in the basis where those monopoles have simple charge assignments, the electric charges are weird. And what they observed is this lets them define an inflation theory that basically winds n times around the field space and can go a super Planckian distance. So does this theory make sense? I'm still not totally sure, but I can tell you a reason to worry. And the reason to worry is their theory involves light electrically charged particles and magnetic monopoles that have a non-minimal Dirac quantization. So this n, 1 and 1, 0 have the Dirac quantum of n. That means that if I take that electrically charged particle in the background of the monopole, it has angular momentum n, and its wave function is probing distances that are n times shorter than the separation between the particles. So you have to be very careful when you tell me the theory has a cutoff. Is the cutoff the radius of the monopole anymore? Well, I don't know. If I let a particle get within a distance of the radius of the monopole, its wave function is probing a distance that's even smaller by a factor of n. So there's at least a reason to sort of be concerned about the validity of the effective theory. Since I'm going over time, let me just skip to saying one concrete way to talk about that potential problem is that as your inflaton is evolving this long distance in field space, you're going to have Kaluza-Klein modes of your particles coming down from the cutoff and becoming light. And so whether you can talk about the whole thing in a single effective field theory becomes unclear. You have modes that are becoming light, that in some other region that's important for inflation were above the scale of your cutoff. So the one model that I know of that kind of looks superficially controlled that could violate this bound that the distance you go in field space is at most m Planck involves this very funny assignment of light, of charges under the electric and magnetic gauge groups to light particles. And I think effective field theory becomes very murky in that context, and we need kind of sharper arguments to tell us if this actually makes sense or not. And I think that actually studying scattering of the charges in the monopole background may be a way to get kind of sharp statements about what the validity of this effective field theory is. Okay.
So the inflation wasn't really playing any important role in that, right? It's really about domains of...
It's about, right, it's about field ranges. I mean...
So what's, if you know, as a counterexample for something where I think you could try and find things in fields, just if I just have the radius of the instrument of the sphere, I think it's radius, kinetic term is VR, or R squared.
Right.
So it gives me, and then R large is where I believe the theory, so I can really certainly have
right. So your radius is a non-compact field.
Right.
I've only been making arguments here about compact axions. So, I certainly haven't said anything that directly applies to that. You do still have to worry that, one thing that you have to worry about when you start taking really large extra dimensions is your Kaluza-Klein modes becoming light, of course, right? So, so in general, the
there's an issue about where your largest radius at which you can do it all in four dimensions.
Yeah.
You're approaching a regime which you know is under control.
I agree. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So it can't be that there's something which forbids transplanting fields.
Yeah, I don't think there's any universal bound on field ranges.
So it sounds like it's very important but, whether it's a compact range or a non-compact range.
Right,
Think that the compact range might be true?
I think there might be a sharp statement that's true about compact ranges. Although, you know, the fact that these arguments relied on a cutoff, you can always worry about some sort of fine-tuning that lets you evade them by some amount. So I don't think there are, at this point, any really sharp arguments against even compact field ranges. But that's the case where I could imagine that there's a relatively strong statement. Certainly non-compact fields make sense. They exist. It is true that if you try to go very far in field space, you're usually bringing down some light mode, either some KK mode or some winding mode. So you might, there might be general statements that you can't go too far in the validity of 1/40 effective field theory.
But you don't have to be in the 40 effective field theory to make your negative
statement. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I agree. So, right, the kind of statement I could imagine being able to make is that kind of statement. And as you say, we might not care if we're in a single 40 effective field theory if we actually understand the UV completion. And yeah, so so I agree. I don't think I've given you a reason to doubt inflation models based on non-compact fields. I'm a little suspicious of some of the axion monotropy models, but not at a level where I have any sharp things to say about them. And for other sorts of non-compact fields like moduli, I guess the thing to wonder about is just that the kinetic terms for those fields tend to not be as simple. I've never tried to think about like Kähler modulus inflation, so I don't have a good sense of what the issues are.
My sense of the axion monotropy is that the weak part in all these models is always
it's not enough to have something that looks right. You have to actually stabilize everything, because even if there's not some speed correction, you're working on it. Because otherwise, that's where you go, right? You don't care if you have some shell over. And I don't know that that's been done right to the end.
I don't think there are any examples that are fully embedded in compact clavios. So I don't think they're explicit constructions. I guess the other thing to say about these inflation arguments I've been giving is these were all based on thinking about kind of a small number of particles that obey either the electric or the magnetic weak gravity conjecture. Now that we're thinking about this more general lattice conjecture, we expect that there are infinitely many particles. Their masses are also growing, but it might be that adding up the whole tower of particles still gives you important effects. So I think all of this stuff kind of has to be rethought once we understand which version of the conjecture is most plausible. Okay. So let me just conclude now. I think large field inflation is really interesting because it's basically the only setting where there's an experiment that I could imagine measuring some number in the near future, which will really force us to ask questions about quantum gravity. You can't avoid thinking about quantum gravity if you want to think about the consistency of theories of large field inflation. And I think this weak gravity conjecture is plausible. We have a huge amount of examples, at least, that we're building up. And if it's true, it leads to at least some tension with large field inflation. So I think it's well motivated to think harder about this from the inflation viewpoint. But I also think it's just really interesting. From the viewpoint of learning about quantum gravity, that this conjecture seems to have a lot of structure built into it. It's telling us about the existence of particles of all possible charges. One hope is there might be some refinement that tells us that particles of all possible spins have to exist. So it might be that this conjecture is kind of a useful frame to use for kind of thinking about quantum gravity in general. So thanks. Okay.
Suppose I have a four helium within normal helium say I take a scalar field and I give it the charge time. That would naively be a violation of the gravity condition. But then I can make this field say condense, in which case it will fix the bottom.
Yeah.
Then it will modify, or how
should I? We haven't thought a lot about what to say about broken gauge theories. What I would say is, if you're breaking,
we don't even know about the Lex magnetism, right? I can take a point of view. Yes, it's a gauge theory at the distances we check, right? But
right.
Is
you're saying the photon could be massive, right?
We know, right?
Right.
So, how do I know?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I would hope to get out of thinking about these general kinds of arguments is a reason to believe that the photon really is massless. I don't think I know an argument like that, and it bugs me, right? So, you know, I don't have a sharp reason. You know, if you came and told me tomorrow that the photon mass is 10 to the minus 60 GeV and you knew this with certainty, I don't have an argument I can tell you that, like, that is theoretically inconsistent, right? And that bothers me. But I guess when it comes to thinking about weak gravity in the context of broken gauge theories, what I would say is there's a range of black hole sizes which are big in radius compared to the cutoff of the theory and small compared to the scale at which that mass matters, on which I would hope that you could still try to apply this sort of criterion. But it's true that everything becomes less sharp in that context. So I'm not sure that I have an answer to that. I would like to say that there's still a meaningful bound because of the separation of scales.
But the mass of the force has to be built in somewhere. Right?
What do you mean by that?
You take the vector mass of the force to infinitely small value, the bound should not be
speed. Right. So I think.
So far, the range of the force doesn't enter in the conjecture.
That's right. I think that goes back to this question about time scales. What we really want is an argument along the lines of, not only does a black hole have to be able to discharge, it has to be able to discharge within some particular timescale, or the theory doesn't make sense. And that would allow us to talk about these cases like a black hole with a black hole coupled to a field which is massive, but on the scale of the black hole, long-ranged. Some of our arguments against inflation models also, we realized that some of the models that we couldn't otherwise rule out with these arguments would be ruled out if we could apply the bound not only at minima of the potential, but at all extrema of the potential. So there would be models where weak gravity was obeyed at the minimum, but violated at a saddle point of the potential. And so if that's going to be a valid argument, what we would want to be true is to say, well, you can sit at that saddle point for a sufficiently long time that you should be able to say the black hole there has to be able to decay before you fall off to some other point. So I think what I would like to have is some sort of thermodynamic argument that has a clear timescale built in that tells me when things have to discharge. I don't have such an argument.
Point out though that we're thinking like Dan Irving.